This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. A couple of remarkable political developments in the world this week. We're going to start by looking at the announcement from Germany that Chancellor Angela Merkel will be stepping down as head of her political party. Longtime Trumpet readers and listeners know that Bible prophecy has a lot to say about German politics and the role they'll play in end time events. This announcement marks the end of an era for Germany. We're going to hear from trumpet writer Richard Palmer about what might happen next and how this might lead to the fulfillment of one of the most dramatic prophecies in the Bible. In our second segment, we'll look at the remarkable election that just occurred in Brazil. This South American nation took a dramatic political turn by electing Jair Bolsonaro as its new president, a conservative, a man tough on crime, a strongman type, a populist. He's been called the Trump of the tropics. What might this mean for Brazil's future, and how might this fulfill biblical prophecy? We'll hear a report on this from trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Then in our third segment, a change of pace. Many people live with occasional aches and pains, especially as we age. But when joint pain, inflammation, or stiffness becomes persistent, you might be suffering from one of about 100 types of arthritis. We'll talk to Jörg Mardian about what causes arthritis and what we can do to prevent it or manage it if we have it. And I also have a last word at the end of the program with some reflections on having some of my friends who are facing life-threatening sicknesses and the importance of making the best possible use of today. We'll start, though, by hearing about Angela Merkel's lightning bolt announcement in Germany in this report from Richard Palmer.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is officially on the way out. On Monday, she announced she'll be stepping down as the leader of Germany's Christian Democratic Union. Soon, she will be gone as Germany's Chancellor. So what is next for Germany? What's on the horizon for Germany? Well, for most, a whole lot of confusion. Now, what does this mean for Germany? Who's the next leader? Where is our nation going? No senior German politician, nobody in the running to succeed Angela Merkel can answer any of those questions. Ms. Merkel's announcement has thrown Germany into confusion. At the same time that Germany's political system has stopped working, it's going through a crisis that's far bigger than one man or one woman. Germany, Europe are more leaderless and adrift than ever now. And they're this way in a dangerous world with mounting crises. And all of this sets the stage perfectly now as we see Angela Merkel leaving for one of the Trumpet's biggest, most controversial, most important forecasts to be fulfilled. So what's next for Germany? Well, Ms. Merkel's party, the Christian Democratic Union, will vote for their new leader in December. Ms. Merkel has said, and that was her big bombshell announcement yesterday, that she won't stand in this election. Then Ms. Merkel has said that she wants to remain in position as Germany's Chancellor until 2021. At this point, Germany is scheduled to hold new elections, and Ms. Merkel said she'll step down and not seek public office anymore after this point. But what does this mean in practice? Well, it means even if Ms. Merkel gets her way, even if she has an ally or supporter of her becomes the CDU party leader, and they're content to let Angela Merkel stay in place as chancellor without being party leader, a very unusual situation. You know, even if that happens, well, every politician in Germany will know for certain Merkel is almost out. You know, there's an expiry date right there on the tin. Why listen to her? Why respect her? Her ability to reward followers and punish foes, you know, has that very specific expiry date on it. And then the same will be true on a European level. And Ms. Merkel so far has provided some small level of leadership in the euro crisis. But then her voice after this point, even if she's still in place as chancellor, will carry no more authority, as all the other leaders will know, well, they just need to wait out the rest of her tenure. and then they'll be dealing with someone new. The Telegraph talked about this point. They wrote, "It's not only in Berlin that decision-making is about to get fiendishly difficult. Brussels has relied on Merkel to give a lead in moments of crisis. Greeks certainly resented the German Chancellor's role in setting the terms of the handling of their financial debacle, but it was done." And then they wrote, "With nobody really in power in Berlin, Brussels lacks a firm hand to whip in the rest of Europe." So we've got confusion, leaderlessness on the European stage. And this we're talking about is Germany's best case scenario, Miss Merkel's best case scenario. The worst case is that a Merkel opponent is voted in as a Christian Democratic Union leader. At this point, Merkel's kind of plan for a long transition becomes toast. A new CDU leader that's against Merkel could have himself voted by German's parliament as the new chancellor if he can convince the rest of the coalition to get on board with that. And if he fails, well, he could pull the CDU out of the coalition and bring on fresh elections. So none of this really helps provide Germany with any real leadership. There's not really much prospect of Germany's problems and leadership crisis going away. Bloomberg had an article yesterday titled "Merkel's Likely Successor, Nobody in Particular." The growing demand for change, however, are not going to be satisfied with more personnel moves, even such momentous ones as Merkel's gradual easing out of power, they wrote. No successor, and then they listed a few options, but no successor will have an easy time winning a broader popular mandate than Merkel. Or they wrote that the public knows what they can offer and finds it irritatingly boring. What voters are looking for is new ideas, clear views, a focus on their day-to-day problems rather than inter- and intra-party strife, wrote Bloomberg. Germany's immediate future appears to be somewhat like that of many other European countries. A shifting electoral landscape, unstable governments, attempts at trial and error that lead to deadlock. Geopolitical Futures made the same point. What is clear is that Germany is tired of its political leaders, but uncertain of who should replace them. This kind of political uncertainty might not matter in most countries, but in Germany, the beating heart of Europe, it has profound international implications. So, Germany wants someone different. Meanwhile, their political system is barely functioning. The rise of the Alternative for Deutschland on the extreme right and the Left Party on the extreme left has gummed up the works. Germany's mainstream parties must either work with one of these extreme parties or they've got to try and put together some kind of left-right coalition. Left-right coalitions struggle, neither the left or the right are happy with them, and it simply pushes more voters to the extreme and the political system becomes more dysfunctional. So we've got all of this uncertainty, unprecedented political situations, dysfunction. The stage is set for someone new to come on the scene, but not through elections, but through more of this background political dealings, political maneuverings, like the kind of thing that emerges from party conferences rather than national votes. Which brings us to that long-standing trumpet forecast, the rise of a German strongman. Jesus Christ himself warned Christians everywhere to watch world events. In Matthew 24, he said, "Watch you therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come." He gave this command in a long prophecy that talked about specific news events and also specific prophecies from the Bible. He told us to look for the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So he told us, Jesus Christ himself told us to watch for the prophecies from the book of Daniel to be fulfilled. This abomination is described in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 31. And here it's clear that it refers to a specific historic event. A king named Antiochus Epiphanes set up the statue of a pagan god in the temple of Jerusalem. And this Antiochus, though he reigned in around 175 to 164 BC. Yet 200 years later, Christ is saying, watch for this to happen. Why would he say, watch for this to happen if this event was something that only happened in the past? It's clear that Daniel prophesied of Antiochus Epiphanes. You know, he wrote long in advance of that particular event, and those events of the reign of Antiochus fulfilled those prophecies. But the fact that Christ referenced this prophecy again and says, watch for this to happen in the future, well, that tells us that what is written in that book, in the book of Daniel, must have another fulfillment coming in the future. They refer to another event that's not yet happened. And once we understand that these Old Testament prophecies have a modern fulfillment, well, we can see that the Bible is full of forecasts of a European strongman. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 23 describes the rise of a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences. And verse 25 tells us that he will be defeated after he stands up against the Prince of Princes. So this dates it. It happens before the return of Jesus Christ. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to 45 contains another closely related end time prophecy. This time it's related to a world power called the King of the North. Just like the king mentioned in Daniel 8, this leader comes to his end. He's defeated by Jesus Christ. And so this prophecy helps us see where this strong man will rule, a major power in the north of this world. This man won't arise within Britain and America. As you can see in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, these nations are the modern descendants of ancient Israel. And other prophecies show us that this king will actually attack and defeat these nations. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 44 describes this fierce king going on to attack nations to the east and to the north of Jerusalem. And Russia and China match that description. So this fierce king doesn't come from Britain and America. He doesn't come from Asia. Well, one of the few places left is Europe. And we see this confirmed in other prophecies. Isaiah 10 verse 5 to 19 gives a similar prophecy about a similar leader. And here it's stated that he's the king of Assyria. And for a long time, we've said that Germany is modern-day Assyria. You can read more proof of that in our article, The Remarkable Identity of the German People. Revelation 13 and verse 17 describe the same power. Here, though, it's described as a beast that disappears from world scene and reemerges, and it's led by a church. The only place that fits that bill is Europe, where you had the Holy Roman Empire emerge on the scene, disappear, come back, disappear, constantly led by the Catholic Church. So we're told time and again throughout the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, to watch for a strong man, and we can put these scriptures together and see that he emerges in Europe. Now the Bible also tells us how he will come to power. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21 says the people shall not give this Antiochus the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So what does it mean? He's not given the honor of the kingdom, but he obtains it by flatteries. Well, the Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary said that the nation shall not by a public act confer the kingdom on him, but he shall obtain it by artifice or by cunning. Barnes notes says that in other words, it shall not be conferred on him by any law or act of the nation or in any regular succession or claim. Mr. Flurry wrote about these verses in November 2002. This man doesn't come into power the honorable way by being voted into office, Mr. Flurry wrote. He takes it dishonorably. He works behind the scenes and comes to power by flatteries, not votes. The stage is set perfectly for this man in Germany right now. We've been saying that this man would come after Merkel, at some point after Angela Merkel. Now, the way that German Chancellor Angela Merkel is leaving office sets the stage perfectly for him to emerge. Paralysis is on the horizon, as far as the eye can see, as far as it comes to the political commentators, with its current electoral system. None of the people being talked about as Ms. Merkel's successor really offer any kind of solution or is greeted by any kind of enthusiasm. And even the political pundits see that. If the nation is going to remain politically paralyzed while there's troubles with terrorism and things like that at home, Europe burning around it, well, Germany will desperately need a strong leader. And they'd be willing to find some kind of sophisticated-sounding rationale for progressing past or temporarily suspending their constitution. They'll need to get a new leader in there, and the political system just won't provide that flexibility. And so we can see the stage being set perfectly for this new strong leader to come in by flatteries. And this is the exciting part of Ms. Merkel's resignation. It sets the stage perfectly for this keynote prophecy. That strong man could be here very soon. Based on these prophecies, we even believe we know who he is. He's not being listed right now as one of the top contenders for Merkel's job by any of the news organizations I've seen. And he may well not be the one voted as Ms. Merkel's replacement in December. But watch Germany's former defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. You can read much more about why we think he's the man in our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. But all of these Bible prophecies are consistent. This man is coming. But these Bible prophecies are also consistent in telling us what comes after. They tell us that this strong man will wreak his destruction just before Jesus Christ returned to earth. Christ himself said this in Matthew 24 and verse 33. When you see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Like we mentioned, Daniel 8:25 tells us this man will stand up against the prince of princes. He shall be broken without hand. Daniel 11:45, he shall come to his end. None shall help him. Revelation 19 verse 19 says that he shall gather his armies and try to fight Christ and be defeated. Daniel chapter 7 verse 22 tells of this power prevailing until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. And then verse 27 describes the inspiring future that comes after this man that we're so close to seeing, that we're seeing the stage set for. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole of heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Habakkuk describes the same period, writing that the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's why this world event is so exciting. It's setting the scene for one of the final dramas of this present evil world. Now, if this strong man spoken of throughout the Bible is around the corner, well, so is the return of Jesus Christ.
That was trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He wrote a trumpet brief yesterday on this subject, and we'll put a link to that and to Gerald Fleury's booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, on the notes for the program today. We'll also have a whole lot more information about this subject in the coming weeks as the situation unfolds. Stay tuned to thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Brazil just elected a new president, a man who could take the country in a very different direction, one that fulfills an important biblical prophecy, as we will hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
In one of the most contentious elections in Brazil's history, retired army captain Jair Bolsonaro was elected president. He won 55% of the vote in a runoff election on October 28, beating out his socialist rival, Fernando Haddad. The motto of Bolsonaro's party is Brazil above everything, God above everyone. He is an avowed Catholic, yet he often attends Baptist religious services. This being the case, Bolsonaro draws support from both Catholic and evangelical voters. Yet many others are staunchly opposed to the conservative politician, who has voiced sympathy for the military dictatorship that ran Brazil between 1964 and 1985, and who has pledged to give Brazilian police officers more latitude to shoot and kill criminals. Here at the Philadelphia Trumpet, however, we're most concerned about how Bolsonaro's election could fulfill Bible prophecy. There's a prophecy in the book of Revelation that describes 10 kings or dictators that partner with a great false church and give their military power over to an arch-dictator known as the Beast. In this verse, it says, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, but they have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the lamb, but the lamb shall overcome them, for he is king of kings and lord of lords." The late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast?, that these 10 kings are 10 strongmen that will reign over a union of 10 European nations in the days just before Jesus Christ's return. Roman Catholicism will be the ideological glue that binds these nations together and that binds other Roman Catholic nations to this empire. It was the Holy Roman Empire that colonized Latin America, so Mr. Armstrong long predicted that the alliance between Europe and South America would grow extremely strong. Bolsonaro is being advised on foreign policy by Prince Louis Philippe de Orleans Braganca, an heir to deposed Brazilian Emperor Pedro II. Braganca sees the Mercosur Trade Alliance as a hindrance to free trade. he wants Brazil to negotiate more trade deals outside the four-country customs union. Meanwhile, Bolsonaro is concerned about the growing influence of China and wants his nation to draw closer to Europe and the United States. On the campaign trail, Bolsonaro repeatedly warned that the Chinese are not buying in Brazil, they are buying Brazil. And this stance places Brazil at odds with many other Latin American nations whose governments have welcomed Chinese investments, loans, and commodity purchases with open arms. Brazil's pivot from China to the West sounds like great news for America in the short term. But the Bible reveals that will ultimately be Catholic Europe that reaps the rewards of this shift. A parallel prophecy to Revelation 17 is contained in Isaiah 47. Here, the church known as Mystery Babylon the Great in Revelation 17 is referred to as the Daughter of Babylon and the Lady of Kingdoms. This passage says that because God is wroth with his people for polluting his inheritance, he turns them over to this lady who will show them no mercy. Since Brazil and the nations of Latin America are dominated by the same religious system as the European Union, it is very likely that Brazil will be part of the revived Holy Roman Empire. In his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, by editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, he writes, "Herbert Armstrong long prophesied, and we expect, the alliance between Europe and South America to grow extremely strong. The most significant factors that will cement this connection are religion and language. Roman Catholicism is the dominant religion of Latin America, but this will not be a union of equals. The Latin American countries will become vassals to Europe." President-elect Bolsonaro, the Catholic elites who back him, and the European aristocrats who advise him are all signs that Brazil is on the cusp of aligning itself with a revived Holy Roman Empire. And anyone who knows the bloody history of the Holy Roman Empire knows that this is terrifying news for the near future. Yet, as Revelation chapter 17, verse 14 says, "These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords."
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You didn't really mention this too much in the report, but this does seem to fit the pattern of nations electing strongmen. What motivated Brazilians to choose Bolsonaro?
Right. There's definitely a pattern, especially motivating what they call like populist strongmen, or basically the people against the elites. You've seen that across Eastern Europe. You've seen that across many Asian nations, where people getting just so fed up with corruption and the establishment and fake news that they're electing strong leaders to like stand up for them against this system, which is definitely what they've seen in Brazil. It's been very, they've struggled for years with corruption. I think the last two presidents there are being tried for political corruption. People are getting sick of it. They took a poll recently where they actually found that the Catholic Church was the most trusted institution in the nation and the military was second unto it. But trust in politicians is at a rock bottom low. Mm-hmm. And so you get someone like Bolsonaro, who's a retired army captain with close ties to the Catholic Church. And
best of both worlds.
The people see him. It's like, here's a military man, a religious man, a military man who's gonna like sweep out the corruption in Brazilian politics.
Right.
And he's got a history of taking some pretty strong stances. He said really great things about another kind of populist strongman in the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, and his his war against the drug cartels there, where he's saying he's wanting to like empower the Brazilian police to take a stronger hand to just shoot criminals in the streets without worrying as much as they have in the past about taking people alive and making sure that putting police officers' life in danger and try to get them to trial.
Yeah, tell us more about his support for the military dictatorship in Brazil.
Yeah, he wasn't. They had a military dictatorship in Brazil from 1964 to 1985, and he was an army captain at the time. In the 90s, he took some very strong stances there. I think he gave an interview on Brazilian intelligence in 1999 where he was saying elections won't change anything in this country. It will only change on the day that we break out into civil war here and do the job that the military regime didn't do, killing 30,000. If some innocent people die, that's fine. In every war, innocent people die.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taking a very strong stance there, and he's backed away from some of that rhetoric about elections not changing anything now that he's won an election.
Mm-hmm.
But he is also taking a lot of his friends from the military who worked with him during the dictatorship and giving them cabinet posts. I think the man he's considering for defense minister is a retired general, which's not unprecedented. I guess the guy who's defense minister for United States right now, James Mattis, is also retired general.
Mm-hmm.
But in Brazil, kind of like America, that is unusual. They usually try to keep a civilian military divide there and give the defense minister post to a civilian, not a general, even if he is retired. So it looks like he is stacking his cabinet with people who were in the military and worked with him during that dictatorship.
You briefly mentioned how this actually could work in America's favor in the short term. It does seem like this could improve relations with the Trump administration.
Yeah, many Latin American nations are very anti-American right now, very pro-China. Chinese is a rising force in there. Now, they said he made that comment about China's not buying in Brazil. They're buying Brazil. So he's trying to, there's several companies China wanted to buy that he's putting the kibosh on. He's like, no, that's we're nationalizing that or keeping that Brazilian.
Mm.
And so there's been a huge market rally since he's been elected. The free markets love the fact that he's in office, and he's been very complimentary of President Trump and talked about how he wants to work closer with the United States, reorient away from China to the United States. So, I mean, in the next couple of years, this actually could be a really good thing for U.S.-Brazilian trade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I mentioned in the report, like due to Bible prophecy, we expect this Brazil is the world's largest Catholic nation, and that will... That religious connection will align it very closely with a rising Holy Roman Empire in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, Europe and America are still kind of allies. They've had it's getting rocky now in the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
But when that divorce comes, we know from Bible prophecy, Brazil's going with Europe. But it is still significant that right now they're kind of in the Asian camp, that they're realigning towards the Western camp.
Mm-hmm.
The United States may still be leading the Western camp, but that's not going to be the case for many months longer.
So you, in your report, you really emphasized that Europe-Latin America connection. Maybe you could just put this... what you would expect to have a much stronger relationship between Europe and Brazil in the context of Europe's other activities in Latin America.
Right, because, I mean, like I said, you do have the religious connection and you have the cultural connection, but Europe's also a huge trade and investment partner in Latin America. And right now, especially, they've really stepped it up in Cuba, trying to get, I think, the European Union is, I just did these calculations recently, but the European Union is the biggest export partner for both Cuba and Brazil. Most the other, as far as that's the term of what Latin American nations buying goods from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The other Latin American nations either get most of their goods from the United States or China amongst the world powers. But so Brazil and Cuba are kind of the two focal points that the European Union is focused on economically.
Mm-hmm.
To get that foothold in Latin America. And we've people who've listened to this program before know that there's another prophecy we didn't get in much today. And Isaiah 23 about like a mart of nations that economically besieges the United States. And of course, both China and Europe are in that mart of nations. But logistically, to besiege, to put United States under economic siege, you couldn't really do it without Latin America. We do we do so much trade with Latin America that as long as those relationships are strong, you're pretty much self-sufficient if you needed to be. And that's something that I think in the article, well, I quoted from Isaiah's End Time Vision in the report. It's a book by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, and that has that will explain Isaiah 23 in detail to anyone who's curious about how that mart of nations, the economic alliance against the United States, plays out.
Right, and also, if anybody wanted more information about just how the role that the Holy Roman Empire, the role that Europe, united Europe, is going to play in world events in the future, you can read our booklet, "The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy," another really powerful resource that would help to show what's happening here in the context. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro. He's working on a story about this for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that online. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Many people live with the annoyance of occasional aches and pains or even chronic pain, especially as we get older. But when joint pain and inflammation and stiffness become persistent, you could be suffering from one of about 100 types of arthritis. This disease afflicts about 91 million Americans today. What causes it, and is there anything we can do about it? To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
So what is arthritis?
Well, arthritis, literally, it means inflammation of a joint. And it's incredibly common today. And as you stated in your opening, there's literally 100 types of arthritis, with one or two that are most common. Some of the ones that you hear less about are lupus or degenerative disc disease. Even fibromyalgia falls under that umbrella. Gout, systemic sclerosis, they're fairly common, but the RA or rheumatoid arthritis or osteoarthritis are the two big guns that are most common today. And the statistics are pretty horrendous with how many people are affected. Osteoarthritis, one of the two big ones, is literally what they would call a wear and tear disease, you know, where the cartilage starts to wear and you start going bone on bone. And it's very painful, especially as you get older. You know, it's common in the hips, the knees, and the hands, you know. And orthodox medicine says it has to do a lot with as we age or our genetics or even being overweight, because that can put a lot of stress on the joints, right? And so it's more of a what we call a mechanical condition. And so if you've led a rough life, if you're a roofer, if you do landscaping, if you do boarding, and, you know, anything like that where you use running with stuff in your hands all the time or kneeling, you're going to get some type of wear and tear, they say, over the years, so over the decades. And so we don't have enough positive bone stress in our life, really. But if we have a hard job, we have too much bone stress. So there's not a balance. The RA or rheumatoid arthritis is what we call an autoimmune disease. And that's it's an inflammatory condition as well, but it really attacks the tissues around the joints. And then that starts the chronic swelling and the burning and the throbbing. And it can be really, really hard on people. And then you get significant joint damage. And 30% of patients in about 3 years they're unable to work with, wow, with RA. So it's quite significant, and it can also attack the heart, the lungs, and other tissues like the muscles and your cartilage and your ligaments. I mean, this is no small matter.
Mm-hmm. So you said the cause of osteoarthritis is the wear and tear of, say, the job where you're carrying heavy burdens and so on. Rheumatoid arthritis, what are the causes of that?
Well, for that, we have to look, again, we have to look at, you know, if it's inflammatory. A lot of diseases today, we say, well, they're inflammatory condition. So we look at, what are we exposed to today? We're exposed to, I think there's 1,700 new chemicals a year that we're exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have absolutely no idea how that affects the body, but we can certainly speculate that it's all hiding in our tissues and in the bones, right? So it attacks the endocrine system, and it, you know, science can't put a finger on how it, the specifics of it, but we can sure guess and say this is not going to have a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Faulty diet is another factor. Arthritis now, many practitioners say it's a gut microorganism composition problem. So if we eat a lot of processed food, it really wrecks the imbalance of the gut microbes. And then we start getting into what we've talked about many times on this show, leaky gut.
Mm-hmm.
Leaky gut. So, and you produce these bacterial changes, and they damage the gut lining over time, and that eventually leads to inflammatory arthritis such as rheumatoid arthritis. You know, and there's also, if we look at root cause as well, is a lot of our foods, the refined foods that we have, they don't have the nutrients that we used to have in the old days. I mean, back in the 60s, we were already lacking up to 40% of the nutrients that we need in our vegetables and fruits because of the faulty way that we bring them up now, you know, with these chemicals that we're using. I mean, imagine today, you know, how we force the ground and really how few nutrients we really bring up in this. I mean, a lot of people scoff at this, but when we do the analysis on this food, we can see that we're lacking. I'll give you one example of arthritis. We usually find that with arthritis, in the site, the pain site, there's a lack of boron. And boron just happens to be the one mineral that we need to toughen the bones up, to strengthen them.
Hmm.
It affects the testosterone and the estrogen, and it makes the bones strong. Well, we find that here in North America, you know, we're just not getting it. In Israel, they have 10% arthritis. They're getting up to, I think, 3 milligrams of boron in the soil. Here in North America, we're not getting that amount. And we have, you know, almost 3 or 4 times the arthritis here. So we have to look at root cause. What are we not getting in our body that then weakens the bones over the decades of use?
Right.
So I think we can put a lot of stress on the bones if we're fed properly.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not poisoned continuously and those type of things, putting stress, you know, we're not, in a nutshell, we're not remineralizing the bones properly.
Mm-hmm.
So every 10 years, you get a regrowth in your skeletal system. But we're not doing that properly. So if we're lacking all of this, yes, those bones are going to become really weak.
One thing I always appreciate about talking with you is just that you're looking at this kind of a problem from the standpoint of what can we do to put ourselves in a position to prevent it or to manage it or to reverse it just through lifestyle rather than you know, so many of the common ways of approaching a problem like this, say in the medical profession, are much more just dealing with the effects. When we're looking at these kinds of causes, you're evaluating, say, how much can we resolve it through nutrition? How can we put the nutrients in the body that are going to strengthen the bones to the point where we're overcoming that anti-inflammatory lifestyle choices through diet? And other things that we might be able to do to reduce the amount of inflammation in our body. How much do these, just from your experience in working with clients as a nutritionist, as a personal trainer, where people are coming to you with various levels of dysfunction? I'm sure that you're, with arthritis being as common as it is, dealing with people who are experiencing various levels of arthritic hindrance in physical activity, you approach this with, here's how we can manage this. These are some solutions that we can give to you. Maybe you could just talk us through that end of it, what we can do to manage or prevent it.
Oh, absolutely. So you started with a medicinal approach. So largely what orthodox medicine does, it offers a variety of options, saying there's an inevitability to that approach, right? You have arthritis, it's genetic or this or that, and we're going to give you either a medication, we're going to inject you, or ultimately we're going to have surgery. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is it doesn't teach cause and effect. So I could really get a knee replacement, total knee replacement, both knees, and continue my lifestyle that's been so horrendous, right? Mm-hmm. And what have I learned? I've learned nothing. So what we need to do is have a plan geared towards a lifestyle of beneficial movement and better eating. And if you're already into problems with bone health, then you need to gear it towards bone health. And it's very specific. We're built for movement, and movement helps joints to stay healthy. We know that. Science shows us that. So strength training has been shown to be 40% beneficial with pain.
You have so pain. If you do strength training, the pain goes down.
It goes down by 40%. I mean, that was a Tufts University study. And, the movement helps preserve, and it helps to support, and it helps to preserve range of motion. We can't just sit. Mm-hmm. Nothing gets better by sitting. So when we move, the synovial fluid production in the knee actually increases a little bit, mm-hmm. And that's what we want. So if you're already suffering, say, greatly, then you have a lot of pain, severe joint damage perhaps, and a lot of functional limitations. That's harder. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't tell somebody, you got to squat here. You might not be able to, but you can walk. You can do elliptical machines. You can do water exercises, or what we call somatic exercises. They're just slow and gentle exercises. But we always say do something to keep moving, because it's going to get worse.
Now, is that the type of thing where you would encourage someone, say, to work to the margins of their discomfort in an effort, say, to increase the range of motion and that type of thing? Or is it more about just generally moving to how much reversal, I guess, is what the question would be. How much reversal of an arthritic condition do you see?
Well, when I have clients, I always say stay underneath the pain. If a 30-degree angle hurts you, you have a sharp pain, come underneath that. Do less than that. You really know your limitations when you have pain. Trust me. If you've had severe arthritis, you know how much you can move. And I always say, don't move into sharp pain. It's just your body's telling you that's enough. Mm-hmm. So we come underneath that. We do gentle work then, gentle movements. Swimming is fantastic exercise. Nice. Walking can be fantastic. Don't overdo it. Watch the length of time that you do it. Watch how much you impact. If you have a lot of aches afterwards, you've probably overdone it. Mm. So here we're looking at prevention, prevention of further deterioration. If you have no pain, but you're working towards healthy bones, then push it a little bit more to have that impact on the bones to actually thicken them. Mm-hmm. So that's one way of prevention. And we're getting there now where there's more, where we're telling people more, yes, you need to move. And the other then is the anti-inflammatory diet. You hit it, the nail right on the head there. So this type of diet, it fights the inflammatory process. And they say now most disease is considered inflammatory. Mm. And it has to do with how we treat our gut, how we treat those 10 trillion or so microbes. You know, if we have some respect for that with good food, then we have some very good, what I call built-in healing processes. Like when you make a cut on your skin and it just, you know, heals over. Mm-hmm. So they're just built in. And some really good examples are, say, healthy oils versus unhealthy oils. Mm. There's a vast difference. Fruits and vegetables, we all know about that, but we don't eat enough of them. Fermented foods mm-hmm. are huge for that. Juices and herbal teas, and even, say, sulfur-based foods like onions and garlic and seaweed, or spirulina is one of my favorites. It's just a wonder food because it acts as a probiotic, you know, and it's just a way to get all these nutrients and to rebuild the gut bacteria. And then, you know, we start working from the ground up and make sure your meat sources are, you know, wild fish, not farm fish. There's a big difference. And a good clean protein like beef and eggs. And make sure that you get them from reputable sources that don't destroy the health values. That little part I just said is going to, a lot of people are going to gloss over that. Mm-hmm. And they can say, I'm already doing that. When I watch people shop, I'm going to tell you, this is a little nugget of truth. Most people don't. Mm-hmm. Reading a label isn't the same as looking for new food value that's still healthy mm-hmm. because you're reading a label. So you should try to get food that still has life in it, and that if you put it on a kitchen table, you know, it's going to spoil mm-hmm. in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. That's a food that's going to help you. There's strong evidence that this type of approach really has either a good preventative problem or approach to our bones, or to keep the bones healthy as we're in a certain state. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is marvelous. Very good practical advice there. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about arthritis, very, very common form of pain that a lot of people experience. He's working on an article on the subject you can watch for on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, as always, for your time, Jörg.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
A friend of mine wasn't feeling well. Her illness lasted for some time, and she decided to get diagnosed. She was shocked to learn that she had a very aggressive form of cancer. She was told she had weeks or mere days left to live. If you suddenly learned today was your last, how would you react? Could you view your life as a success? If I heard that news, it would be hard not to be stricken with regrets. I should have done this better. I should have devoted more energy to that. I should have squandered less time on this. Jesus Christ tells us, I know your works. When he returns, it says in Matthew 16, he shall reward every man according to his works. If you were measured only by your works up to today, what reward would you receive? Generally, the younger we are, the easier it is to behave as though our days are innumerable. The future always holds promise. One day, I'll climb that mountain. One day, I'll conquer those weaknesses and sins. One day, I'll build that character trait. One day means not today. But what if you only have today? What if you have fewer todays than you think? As you age, those one days become too lates and never dids. And you come to realize how, as it says in 1 Peter 1, all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass. All the days of our years pass quickly. They're easily misspent. It says in Psalm 90, So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. End-of-life situations make us acutely aware of how precious today is. In another case, a man learned he had a deadly condition mere weeks before it claimed his life. And not long afterward, his widow told me that the two of them had treated each of those final days as a gift. She said, "The last 3 weeks were the best weeks of our marriage. All those things you get irritated about, suddenly those don't seem so important. We just enjoyed each other." Isn't it a shame that it can take the threat of dying to make us number our days, to awaken us to our mortality, to convince us to value life and cherish what is precious? Another woman I spoke with has a rare and serious condition about which she can do little. It could remain unthreatening indefinitely, or it could kill her at any time. And what is her attitude? She says she's excited, whatever happens. I know a lot of older people who've learned that kind of serene perspective in their sunset years, but this woman is a young mother with small children. She trusts that God is keenly aware of that reality, and she's placing her future and her life in His hands. That takes unusual spiritual maturity. How does God view the death of one of His saints? Well, He says in Psalm 116, verse 15, that it is precious. For the individual whose life is hid in God, death truly does mean the end of a struggle. The next waking moment is glorious godhood. You can see that in 1 Corinthians 15. It calls it a victory. That person will rise in a world where Satan is banished and Christ is king. That world is everything we long for. It's like Christ returning immediately. If you learned you were about to jump straight into that future, wouldn't you be excited? It's as if God is saying, "I know you. You have qualified. I'm ready to make you a God being in my family." The more you are using each day, each today, to serve God, the greater works He'll be doing in your life, the greater your reward will be when He grants you eternal life. That's an exciting perspective. That's God's perspective. Of course, we missed loved ones when we lose that day-to-day sharing of life. And even that bespeaks the need to, like that couple, to use each day we do have to express and grow in godly love rather than squandering it with pettiness. Just a few weeks before she received her diagnosis, my friend had no palpable sense of how close to death she was. Then one day she learned she had mere days left. Practically speaking, her period of qualification and judgment was nearly over. The number of talents she had earned was nearly set and measurable, if you want to look at it the way that Christ described it in the parable of talents, Matthew 25. Some of us find out ahead of time we have only a few todays left. Some of us don't. The vapor that is your individual physical life could end at any time. So there's only one day you can do anything with, and that day is today. Use this tiny window of time for its real purpose, to love and serve God, to express and grow in godly love, to share your life with your loved ones, to qualify for your eternal position. You and I have no guarantee that there's more than one day left for us to qualify to enter God's family and to secure the greatest possible spiritual reward. That day is the day we're living right now. Pray forgiveness for wasted time, for misspent energy, overlooked opportunity. Stop saying, "One day I'll get around to that." That one day is today. I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Leo Tolstoy. What counts in making a happy marriage is not so much how compatible you are, but how you deal with incompatibility. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.